I'm Aislinn Antrim with Pharmacy Times. Welcome to Psychedelic Pharmacy, where we take a look at one of the fastest growing markets in healthcare, psychedelic medicine. This month, I spoke with Peyton Nyquist, CEO and founder of Numinous, about the production side of psychedelic compounds and why he believes psychedelic medicines will lead to a significant shift in the mental health treatment landscape in the next 3 to 5 years. Numinous is licensed to produce, sell, export, and deliver psychedelic compounds. And Nyquist said that has been an exciting opportunity to build the processes for testing these compounds.
For us, it's been a really exciting opportunity to start to really dig into not only the production side of psychedelics, but also to be able to build the processes, to be able to do analytical testing and really provide the analytical testing support for this space, especially as we start to create products that need to fit FDA and Health Canada requirements as well. And while the licensing is really exciting for us, I think for us also, you know, the lab has been operating for over 10 years in the space and we have a deep amount of experience with these different materials. So for us, the licensing has been a great enabler for us to actually continue to do this work in the space and in a robust and thorough way. And I think for us, where we see some opportunities that maybe aren't currently being met is the opportunities to create naturally sourced products as well that do fit the standardization and requirements of the FDA and Health Canada, but from a natural source, which when we talk about psychedelics, there's a keen interest for, I think, a naturally produced product as well.
Nyquist also said that the lab is working on a variety of research, including research around psilocybin and MDMA.
For MDMA, we're currently in collaboration with MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, that currently has MDMA in FDA phase 3 clinical trials. And we have an open label clinical study using MDMA for PTSD to start to move MDMA into a real world context. And then with psilocybin, we have a number of initiatives going on, a couple of single arm open label clinical studies with psilocybin for substance use disorder. But also out of the lab, we've been licensed by Health Canada to harvest, cultivate, and extract a natural psilocybin product that will be running through a phase 1 clinical trial and then quickly moving into phase 2.
When asked whether all treatments in this space are focusing on a clinic model for distribution, Nyquist said the inclusion of trained practitioners with these treatments is crucial.
You know, if you look at the MAPS research, really proves and validates the real necessity of the therapeutic container and that the trained practitioners being able to guide somebody through some of these experiences is really crucial, if not more crucial than the actual psychedelic drug itself. So for us, that's some of the other work we've been doing is providing the clinical infrastructure to be able to actually house these therapies. You know, the way we've typically dispensed or worked with mental health medications is through an SSRI or something like that, whereas this is a more of an intervention-based model using psychedelics with psychotherapy to disrupt and potentially cure some of these mental health indications that people are struggling with.
Access is a significant concern with the advent of psychedelic medicines, especially among populations of color and rural communities where access to mental health care has historically been difficult. Nyquist said improving access to psychedelic medicines could take many forms.
For us, that's been a significant amount of the work that we've been looking to do is how do we make psychedelic therapy accessible for people? And that looks like many different things, whether that's physical locations, trying to make them more cost effective, but also making sure that our practitioners are diverse and are trained in cultural safety and humility practices. And, you know, really making sure that we're providing accessibility for everybody. So I think you're seeing more and more emphasis on that from groups, which is wonderful to see. And for us, a significant amount of the work that we've been doing also. And I think psychedelics really play an interesting role in potentially being able to bridge some of that work as well.
Regulations are, of course, a vital part of the discussion around psychedelic medicines. And Nyquist said regulatory changes could support greater access to psychedelic-assisted therapies.
I think ketamine right now, obviously, is the most used psychedelic at the moment. It's the first sort of legal psychedelic that we have. You've started to see Canada open up ketamine-assisted psychotherapy more and more. The US is a little bit ahead of Canada in terms of accessibility of ketamine. MDMA is going to very much go, I think, the sort of clinical trial approved pharmaceutical, have a DIN number sort of process. I think psilocybin is an interesting question. I could foresee psilocybin going more of a medical access model. If you look at what Oregon has done about a year ago, is they've moved to just legally providing access to psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy. And I think Health Canada, you know, from what they've shown with the Section 56 exemptions and most recently the intention to change the special access drug program to include MDMA and psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy, I think psychedelics could go a unique pathway in terms of regulation change and accessibility, and not just go a pure pharmaceutical FDA clinical trial approval process. Though they are in those processes at the moment, I think you could maybe see a different access point.
Because psychedelic-assisted therapy is a relatively new field of research that is not taught in traditional curriculums, training healthcare professionals will be important.
That's still a big question in terms of, is there going to be a standard or accredited program that is going to be required for practitioners? We still don't have the answers to those questions yet. Though you are seeing more and more training being offered, especially to practitioners, around not only psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, but starting to provide experiential-based training with ketamine and also some of the work that MAPS has been doing with MDMA. MAPS has now started to be able to provide experiential-based training for MDMA-assisted psychotherapists. And that's a big part of the work that we've been doing with them as well, is making sure that we have the trained workforce to be able to actually provide MDMA-assisted psychotherapy.
Nyquist also said he's very excited for the future of psychedelic medicine, and he sees a lot of potential for the involvement of pharmacists in the psychedelic medicine industry.
I think over the next 3 to 5 years, I see a complete paradigm shift in healthcare and how psychedelics fit within that system. I think psychedelics could be really used as some of the first modalities in treating different mental health indications and even moving towards just mental wellness as well and the opportunities there. And I think for pharmacies, I think hugely important in terms of, you know, these are still scheduled drugs, and we don't think that they're necessarily going to move out of a scheduled process. They're going to be regulated, and for pharmacies to be able to help with the storage, the administration, all of those things, I think is going to be really crucial. And frankly, something that is probably a little bit underlooked right now in terms of how psychedelics are actually going to flow from a distributor to a practitioner or to a clinic. I think there's a lot of work to be done there still too.
Finally, Nyquist said he is incredibly excited about the future of this field and its potential for patients.
As I mentioned before, I think over the next 3 to 5 years, I think you see psychedelics really become a standard of care. And I think obviously at a time where couldn't be more needed, we've really proven that though best efforts applied, we're not doing a good job of treating mental health disorders. And it's needed now more than ever. So I do think that this space continues to evolve very, very quickly. There's an amazing amount of clinical research currently being done. And I think those results are going to continue to hopefully be positive. The momentum is certainly there, and it feels like the stigma has also shifted. So I think you're going to continue to see more and more emphasis and interest in the space.
In addition to the modern research around psychedelic medicine, the history of medicine is full of fascinating findings and alternative approaches to both medical practice and drug research. Each episode, Alana Hippensteel of Pharmacy Times will explore a historical approach to medicine that, despite its sometimes odd or bizarre nature, remains foundational to modern developments in the field.
In the 19th century, an Austrian man named Vincent Priesnitz went down in history for miraculously healing himself from a rib injury that his doctor had proclaimed would lead to a most certain death. In his notes, the physician wrote that Priesnitz, by a stroke of intuition, inexplicably cured his injury by drinking lots of water, cleaning his wounds with compresses soaked in cold water, and regularly changing his bandages. This process would come to be dubbed, at the time, a water cure. After this magical cure, Prysznitz was able to get back to his farming duties within several days. The physician was stunned, and Prysznitz quickly became the talk of the town. In this period of time, such treatment of an injury was not commonplace, and Prysznitz became known as a healer who used the power of water to cure all manner of injuries and illness. Due to his growing notoriety as the man who experienced a miraculous water-based recovery, he established the Grafenberg Water Cure in 1826 in the Austrian Alps, which was the first establishment of many that would come to be called hydropathic institutes. Common treatments at hydropathic institutes included the wet sheet, which comprised of tightly wrapping an ill patient in a sheet soaked in cold water, to the wet dress, which involved having an ill patient put on a loose-fitting gown soaked in cold water, to the more classic and self-explanatory cold water enema. Patients touted these institutes for their health-restorative abilities. Additionally, women of the time noted the specific benefits they experienced from the wet dress cure, as it allowed them the opportunity to move around the hydropathic institute not in a corset. The wet dress became so popular among women that a not-wet street version developed, which was then frequently worn by the likes of Elizabeth Smith and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, both leaders of the women's rights movement in the United States at the time. Journalist Amelia Bloomer touted their fashion-forward prowess ad nauseum, leading the fashion statement to eventually be dubbed Bloomers as a form of acknowledgement of her specific enthusiasm for them.
Thanks for listening to Psychedelic Pharmacy, a pharmacy-focused series. Tune in next month to hear from Colonel Dallas Hack, Director of Medical Affairs at Magic Med, about the development of a novel derivative of psilocybin for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder.